Okay, so you're getting ready to dive headfirst into the world of nursing, right?
Right.
Well, today we're going deep on something that's absolutely crucial no matter where you end up practicing.
Oh, absolutely.
We're talking about assessing fetal well-being. Like, how do we know a baby is thriving in the womb? You know, what
Right.
are the signs? What are the tests? What do we need to be looking out for?
Yeah, and this is all about being that advocate for your littlest patients, even before they take their first breath. It's like a whole other level of nursing, you know what I mean?
Exactly. And to guide us through all of this, we've got this amazing study guide. It's packed with info on all the different ways we evaluate a baby's health while they're still inside, in utero.
Yeah, it's not just about like memorizing a bunch of tests. It's about getting what those tests actually tell us, you know, connecting the dots.
Exactly. And for all of you future nurses out there, this isn't just some theoretical stuff you'll forget after the exam. Like, this is real-world, boots-on-the-ground knowledge that you're going to be using every day.
Oh, for sure.
Because you're going to be the ones monitoring those babies, those moms, picking up on subtle cues and knowing when something might be off.
Absolutely.
It's about having that clinical judgment, that instinct.
Totally.
So today, we're breaking it all down, making this complex stuff super clear, and really highlighting why it matters for your future as a nurse.
That's the goal.
Okay, let's jump right in.
All right.
Where do we even start with assessing fetal well-being? I mean, what's the basic thing we can look at?
Well, you know, the beautiful thing is that even before all those fancy tests and scans, the pregnant person themselves can play a huge role in monitoring their baby's well-being.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
It's all about fetal movement.
Oh, right, feeling those little kicks.
Exactly. Those kicks, those little squirms and flutters, it's often the first tangible sign of life for the mother.
Yeah, total.
And it's a pretty reliable indicator of how the baby's doing at any given moment.
Okay, so when we talk about fetal movement, we hear about kick counts a lot.
Yeah.
What's the deal with those?
Yeah, so kick counts are just a simple way for the mother to keep track of how often their baby is moving. You know, they start to feel those movements pretty consistently around week 28 or so.
Okay.
And we generally look for at least 10 distinct movements within a 2-hour window when the baby is typically most active.
Okay, so that's what's considered normal, 10 movements in 2 hours.
Right, generally speaking.
So, what if a mom notices, like, a few less kicks one day? Is that a reason to panic?
Well, not necessarily. See, one day with slightly fewer kicks might not be a huge deal. It's more about the overall trend.
Oh, you mean like if the movements are gradually decreasing over a few days?
Exactly. Like if the mom notices a consistent pattern of fewer kicks over several days, that's when it becomes a bit more concerning.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's not just a one-off thing. It's more about looking for a pattern.
Right, exactly. Like, let's say the baby usually moves a ton in the evenings, but then over a few days, the mom notices less and less movement during that time.
Okay, that's a red flag.
Yeah, that's definitely something to bring up with their healthcare provider right away.
All right, so we're talking about kick counts, moms feeling those movements. Is there anything else moms can do at home to kind of, keep tabs on how their baby's doing?
Absolutely. You know, one of the simplest but most powerful things moms can do is keep a fetal movement log. It's super easy, like just a little notebook or even an app on their phone where they jot down the time they start counting and then mark down each movement they feel.
Okay, so just a simple record of when the baby's kicking.
Yep, that's it. It helps them get to know their baby's individual patterns of activity, which is super important.
Right, because every baby's different.
Oh, totally. Some babies are little ninjas in there, you know, constantly moving, and others are more laid back.
Yeah, that's true. What about those home fetal Dopplers? The ones you can buy to listen to the baby's heartbeat at home. Do those have a role in all of this?
Oh, those Dopplers. Yeah, those are interesting. They can definitely provide some reassurance for the mother. You know, hearing that heartbeat can be really comforting.
Yeah, I bet.
But, and this is super important for you guys as future nurses to remember, a home Doppler is not a substitute for a professional medical evaluation.
Okay, so it's not like a foolproof way to know if everything's okay.
Right. Just because you hear a heartbeat doesn't tell you anything about the strength or frequency of those movements. And that's what we're really looking at with kick count.
Oh, that's a really important distinction. So if a home Doppler isn't the be-all end-all, when should a pregnant person absolutely call their doctor or midwife? Like, what are the red flags when it comes to fetal movement?
So anything that's a major change from their baby's usual pattern is worth a call, especially if they're feeling fewer than 10 movements within that 2-hour window we talked about, or if the movements stop altogether.
Okay, so less than 10 movements in 2 hours, or no movement at all. Got it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's always better to err on the side of caution. We'd rather reassure a mom than miss a potential issue.
Absolutely. So as future nurses, what are the key things we need to teach pregnant people about fetal movement? What do they absolutely need to know?
So many important things. First, we've got to make sure they really get what's normal and what's not in terms of their baby's movements, you know, mm-hmm. keeping in mind how far along they are in the pregnancy.
Okay.
Then we've got to walk them through exactly how to do those kick counts and keep track of them in their log.
Right. Step by step.
Yep. And then it's about helping them understand, like, the patterns of their baby's movements. Do they tend to move more at night after meals? Once they kind of figure out their baby's usual groove, it'll be easier for them to notice any changes that might be concerning.
So paying attention to those patterns and noticing when things are different.
Exactly. And then just emphasizing that, regularly checking those movements, especially as they get further along in the third trimester, should become just a regular part of their prenatal routine.
Got it. Okay, so that covers how moms can monitor their babies at home. Now let's talk about what we can learn in the healthcare setting. Ultrasound has got to be one of the biggest game changers in prenatal care, right?
Oh, absolutely. Ultrasound is like this incredible window into the womb. It's amazing what we can see and learn using sound waves.
And there are so many different types of ultrasounds done throughout a pregnancy, right?
Right. And we use them for different things depending on how far along the pregnancy is. So like in the first trimester, that's those early weeks, ultrasound is super important for a few things. Like first, we got to make sure the pregnancy is actually inside the uterus where it should be. You know, sometimes it can implant in the fallopian tubes or somewhere else, which is an ectopic pregnancy, and that's a whole other issue.
Right. So confirming the location of the pregnancy, that's key.
Absolutely. Then we're looking to see if the pregnancy is viable. Like, is there a heartbeat? Is the embryo developing as expected?
Okay, so making sure everything is looking healthy and on track.
Exactly. And then we can use ultrasound to really accurately date the pregnancy. Especially in those early weeks, measuring the crown rump length, which is the length from the top of the baby's head to their little bottom, is super precise for figuring out how far along the pregnancy is.
So basically getting an accurate due date.
Yep. And it can also tell us if there's more than one baby in there. You know, twins, triplets. Ultrasound will show us that.
Wow, so much information from those early ultrasounds. Okay, so what about second trimester? What are we focusing on then?
Second trimester is when we do this really amazing detailed ultrasound called the fetal anatomy scan. It's like taking a high definition tour of the baby's developing body.
That's got to be incredible to see.
Oh, it is. It allows us to check out the baby's brain, heart, spine, literally all the major organs and make sure everything's developing as it should. We're looking for any potential structural issues that we might need to address.
So, like, early detection is key here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The earlier we can identify any potential problems, the better. It gives us more time to plan and prepare for the baby's arrival, maybe even consider interventions if necessary.
Makes sense. What else can we see in the second trimester ultrasound?
Oh, we also take a close look at the placenta, which is the organ that nourishes the baby, and make sure it's in a good spot. We don't want it blocking the cervix, for example. And we also measure the amount of amniotic fluid surrounding the baby. That fluid is crucial for the baby's development, and too much or too little can sometimes signal a problem.
Okay, so placenta and amniotic fluid, got it. And then third trimester, what are we looking at as we get closer to delivery?
Third trimester ultrasounds are all about monitoring the baby's growth, you know, making sure they're gaining weight appropriately.
Okay. How do you measure that in an ultrasound?
Oh, we take measurements of different parts of the baby's body, like the biparietal diameter, which is the width of their head, and the femur length, which is the length of their thigh bone.
Intense.
And we plot these measurements on growth charts to see if they're following a healthy trajectory. We also check on the baby's position to see how they're lying in the uterus.
Ah, yeah. Got to make sure they're head down for delivery.
Ideally, yeah. And then, of course, we're still paying attention to the placenta and amniotic fluid levels.
So it's kind of like checking in on all those things we've been monitoring throughout the pregnancy.
Exactly. Making sure everything's still looking good as we head towards the finish line.
Okay, so we've talked about what we can actually see with ultrasound, like the baby's anatomy and position. But what about the practical applications? Like, how does all of this ultrasound information actually guide how we manage a pregnancy?
Oh, it's huge. Like, think about it. Ultrasound allows for early diagnosis of so many things. We can pick up on congenital anomalies like heart defects or spina bifida way before the baby's born.
So we can start planning and preparing for any special needs the baby might have?
Exactly. And we can catch things like intra-tetter and growth restriction. That's when the baby isn't growing as well as we'd expect, and address it early. Or we can identify problems with the placenta, like placenta previa, where the placenta is blocking the cervix. That can cause serious bleeding during labor, so we need to know about it in advance.
Wow, so much crucial information.
Right. And ultrasound is key for managing high-risk pregnancies, too. Like, if a mom has diabetes or high blood pressure, ultrasound helps us keep a close eye on how those conditions might be affecting the baby.
Okay, so it's not just about looking at the baby, it's about getting all this information that helps us manage the pregnancy as a whole.
Exactly. And then for follow-up, we use ultrasound to track fetal growth over time and to see how things are progressing. It helps us make sure our interventions are working if needed and that the baby's on the right track.
Okay, so ultrasound is like this powerhouse of information. Now, I know when you look at an ultrasound report, there are all these measurements and findings. As nurses, what are the key things we need to know about interpreting those results?
So you'll want to be familiar with the different measurements we take at different stages of pregnancy. Like early on, it's that crown rump length, and later it's the biparietal diameter and femur length.
Right, we talked about those.
And these measurements are used to estimate the gestational age, like how far along the pregnancy is, and to track growth. And you also need to know that any findings that fall outside the expected range, that deviate from what's considered normal, that's something to pay attention to.
Like it might mean we need to do more testing or consider some kind of intervention.
Exactly. It could be a
Wow.
sign that something needs further investigation.
Got it. Okay, so we've got all this information coming from the ultrasound. What are our key nursing considerations when a patient is having an ultrasound? What's our role in all of this?
Well, a big part of our job is patient education, right?
Right.
We need to clearly explain to the mom what the ultrasound is all about, what we're looking for, and what to expect during the scan. Sometimes people get nervous about the gel, the probe, the whole thing.
Yeah, it can be a little weird if you've never had one before.
Totally. And then after the ultrasound, we have to make sure the patient understands the findings, and we need to be sensitive too. Some findings might be scary or unexpected, so we have to be prepared to provide support and answer questions in a way that's compassionate and reassuring.
Absolutely. It's not just about the technical stuff, it's about being there for the patient emotionally.
Exactly.
Okay, we've covered how moms can monitor their babies at home. And then the amazing information we can get from ultrasound. Now let's dive into some of those more specific diagnostic tests that can give us even more insight into fetal well-being.
Sounds good.
So, our study guide talks about Doppler studies. What can you tell us about those?
So, Doppler studies are kind of like a specialized type of ultrasound. It uses sound waves, but instead of creating pictures of the baby, it focuses on blood flow.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it measures how fast the blood is moving in the baby's blood vessels, especially in the umbilical cord, and also in the mom's blood vessels that supply the placenta.
Okay, so it's all about assessing blood flow.
Right. And this gives us really important information about how well the placenta is working, which is essential for the baby to get the oxygen and nutrients they need.
So if the blood flow isn't great, that could mean the placenta isn't functioning properly.
Exactly. We call that placental insufficiency, and it can be a serious problem.
Okay, that makes sense. So what are the nursing considerations when a patient's having a Doppler study? What should we be thinking about?
Well, we gotta understand that abnormal blood flow patterns, like if the blood flow is too slow or too turbulent, that can be a red flag for placental insufficiency.
Got it.
And we need to be prepared to explain that to the patient. Sometimes if the Doppler results aren't what we hoped for, it might mean we need to do more testing to get a clearer picture of what's going on.
Right. So it's about preparing the patient for that possibility and providing support if we do need to move forward with more tests.
Exactly.
Okay. The next test on our list is the non-stress test, or NST. Just the name makes it sound pretty straightforward.
It really is.
So, what exactly does an NST involve?
So basically, it's just monitoring the baby's heart rate for about 20 to 40 minutes. And we're specifically looking to see how that heart rate responds to the baby's movements.
Oh, okay. So, like when the baby kicks or moves, we'd expect to see a change in their heart rate.
Exactly.
What kind of change?
Well, a healthy baby who's getting enough oxygen, their heart rate will usually speed up or accelerate when they move.
Okay, that makes sense.
So during an NST, we're looking for at least two of these accelerations, each one going up by at least 15 beats per minute above the baseline heart rate and lasting for at least 15 seconds.
And that's considered a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
It means the baby's central nervous system is working like it should, and they're likely getting enough oxygen. We call that a reactive NST.
Reactive, got it.
Mm-hmm.
So what about our role as nurses during an NST? What are our responsibilities?
Well, one of the biggest things is making sure the mom is comfortable.
Right, because if she's uncomfortable, that can affect the baby's movements.
Totally. And stress can influence the baby's heart rate, too. So, you know, dimming the lights, providing pillows, making sure she's in a comfy position, all that stuff can help.
Okay, so creating a relaxing environment is key.
Absolutely. And then we want to explain everything clearly to the mom, what we're looking for, what the different patterns on the monitor mean, what those potential outcomes could be.
Right, keeping her informed throughout the process.
Definitely.
All right, so next up we've got the contraction stress test, or CST. This one sounds a little more involved than the NST.
It is a little more hands-on, yeah.
So what exactly is happening during a CST?
Well, unlike the NST, which is just passive monitoring, a CST involves actually stimulating the uterus to contract.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There are a couple of ways to do it. Sometimes we'll give a low dose of oxytocin through an IV, which triggers contractions. Or sometimes we can use nipple stimulation, which also releases oxytocin naturally.
Okay, interesting. And what's the point of inducing those contractions?
So the idea is to see how the baby's heart rate responds to the stress of those contractions.
I see.
Like if the placenta is doing its job and providing enough oxygen, even during contractions, the baby's heart rate should stay stable.
Okay. But if the placenta isn't functioning well, what would we see on the monitor?
Well, that's when we might see those late decelerations.
Late decelerations. What are those?
So basically, it's when the baby's heart rate dips down after the peak of the contraction and then slowly recovers.
It's like a delayed response to the contraction.
Right. And if we see consistent late decelerations, that could be a sign that the baby isn't getting enough oxygen during contractions, which is a problem.
Okay, that's definitely something you want to avoid. So what are our main nursing responsibilities during a CST? What do we need to be on top of?
So definitely monitoring. We're keeping a close eye on that fetal heart rate the whole time, watching for any concerning patterns like those late decelerations. And we're also paying attention to the mom's contractions, making sure they're not too strong or too frequent, you know, because we don't want to cause any distress.
Right. We want to make sure she's comfortable, too.
Exactly. And then we got to be prepared to stop the test if we see any really worrying signs.
Yeah.
Like if those late decelerations are happening a lot, we might need to intervene.
And what would that intervention look like?
Well, it depends on the overall situation, but it could involve giving the mom oxygen, changing her position, or even delivering the baby early if things are looking really bad.
Wow. Okay. So CST is a bit more high stakes than the NST.
It can be, yeah. But it gives us really valuable information about how the baby might handle labor and delivery.
All right. Moving on. Our study guide also mentions the biophysical profile, or BPP. This one sounds like it's kind of a combination of some of the things we've already talked about.
You got it. BPP is like this more comprehensive evaluation that looks at a bunch of different things to get a really good picture of how the baby's doing. It combines ultrasound and the NST into one test.
Oh, that makes sense. So what exactly are we looking at during a BPP?
So with ultrasound, we're checking for four specific things. Fetal breathing movements, like is the baby practicing breathing in the womb?
Okay.
Gross body movements, you know, those big movements like stretching and kicking.
Got it.
Fetal muscle tone, which is basically their muscle strength and reflexes, and then the amount of amniotic fluid.
Right. Always important to keep an eye on that amniotic fluid.
And then along with the ultrasound, we're also doing an NST to check the baby's heart rate and how it responds to those movements.
Okay, so it's like a two-for-one deal.
Basically.
Yeah.
And each of those five things, the four from the ultrasound and the NST, gets a score of either 0 or 2, 2 being good, 0 being not so good.
And then we add all those scores up.
Yep, you add them all up and you get a total score out of 10. So the best possible score is a 10.
Perfect 10. Okay, so what's considered a good score? What scores should we be concerned about?
So a score of 8 to 10 is generally considered reassuring, like the baby's doing well.
Awesome.
A 6 is kind of a gray area. We might repeat the test in 24 hours or consider doing some additional tests to get more information. But if the score is 4 or lower, that's a red flag. It could mean the baby's in distress and might need to be delivered early.
Wow. Okay, so the BPP score really helps us figure out if there's a need for intervention.
It does, yeah.
So for our future nurses out there, What do we need to make sure patients understand about the BPP?
Well, you know, explaining what it involves, why we're doing it, emphasize that it gives us this really comprehensive picture of the baby's well-being, more than just one test alone.
Okay.
And then explain that scoring system. You know, keep it simple. Make sure they understand that a higher score is better.
Right, like a school report card almost.
Exactly. And then let them know that if the score isn't ideal, it might mean we need to do more testing or even consider delivering the baby sooner rather than later.
So it's about being transparent and making sure they feel involved in the decision-making process.
Definitely.
Okay, we're making good progress here. Let's move on to another assessment. Nutral translucency screening. This one happens pretty early in pregnancy, right?
Yeah. Nutral translucency, or NT screening, is usually done between 11 and 14 weeks.
Okay, so first trimester.
Mm.
And what exactly are we looking at with this screening?
So it's a specific ultrasound measurement. We're looking at the fluid-filled space at the back of the baby's neck.
Okay.
And if that space is larger than normal, that can be associated with certain chromosomal abnormalities.
Like Down syndrome.
Exactly. Down syndrome is one of the main ones. But it can also be a sign of other conditions like heart defects.
Got it. So what happens if the nutral translucency measurement is larger than expected? Like, what are the next steps?
Well, it's really important to emphasize to patients that an abnormal NT measurement is just a risk factor, not a diagnosis.
Okay, that's key.
Like, it doesn't automatically mean something is wrong with the baby. It just means there's a slightly higher chance of a problem.
So we need to do more testing to know for sure.
Exactly. If the NT measurement is abnormal, we'll usually recommend further testing, like chorionic villus sampling or amniocentesis. Those are diagnostic tests that can give us more definitive answers.
Okay, so NT screening is more like a heads up, a possible indication that something might be off, and then we do more invasive testing if needed to confirm or rule out any problems.
Right. That's a good way to put it.
Okay. So speaking of those more invasive tests, let's talk about amniocentesis and chorionic villus sampling, or CVS. They're both ways to get genetic information about the baby. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's the main purpose. And they both involve taking a sample of something, but what we're sampling and how we do it is a little different for each one.
Okay. Let's start with amniocentesis. Walk us through that one.
So amniocentesis is usually done later in pregnancy, after 15 weeks. We use ultrasound to guide us, and then we insert a thin needle through the mom's abdomen and into the uterus to withdraw a small sample of amniotic fluid.
Amniotic fluid, that's the fluid surrounding the baby, right?
Yep, exactly. And that fluid contains fetal cells and other substances that we can analyze in the lab to get a ton of information about the baby.
Okay, so what kind of information are we getting?
Well, one of the main reasons we do amniocentesis is for genetic testing. Like, we can grow those fetal cells from the fluid and analyze their chromosomes.
To look for any chromosomal abnormality.
Exactly, like Down syndrome or other trisomies.
Got it.
And we can also do molecular testing to look for specific gene mutations that might cause certain genetic disorders, especially if there's a family history of a particular condition.
Okay, so we can get really specific information about the baby's genes.
We can. And then later in pregnancy, we can also use the amniotic fluid to assess how mature the baby's lungs are.
Well, that's important, especially if there's a chance of preterm delivery.
Absolutely. So we look at the ratio of two substances in the fluid. Lecithin and sphingomyelin. It's called the LS ratio.
Okay.
And we look for another substance called phosphatidylglycerol, or PG. These tell us how well the baby's lungs are developing and if they'd be able to function properly if they were born early.
So that's crucial information for making decisions about preterm labor.
Absolutely. And then amniotic fluid can also be tested for infections. You know, sometimes bacteria can get into the amniotic sac, which can be dangerous for the baby.
Wow. Okay, so amniocentesis is like a multi-purpose tool.
It is. We also measure something called alpha fetoprotein in the fluid, which can help screen for open neural tube defects like spina bifida.
Okay, so it sounds like amniocentesis can give us a lot of valuable information, but it is an invasive procedure, right? Are there risks involved?
Yeah, there are some risks, like with any invasive procedure.
What are those risks?
Well, the biggest one is the risk of miscarriage.
Oh, right.
It's a small risk, but it's something we always have to discuss with patients beforehand. And there's also a small risk of infection. You know, anytime we're inserting a needle into the uterus, there's a chance of introducing bacteria.
Right.
And then very rarely, there's a risk of the needle hitting the baby. But with ultrasound guidance, that's extremely uncommon.
Okay, good to know.
And are there any other potential complications?
Yeah, sometimes amniocentesis can trigger premature rupture of the membranes, which means the amniotic sac breaks open and the fluid starts leaking out.
Oh, wow. Okay, so there are definitely some things to consider. What are our key nursing responsibilities when caring for a patient who's having an amniocentesis?
So education is huge. Before the procedure, we need to make sure the patient completely understands what the procedure entails, why we're doing it, the potential benefits, but also those risks we talked about.
Right. Informed consent is crucial.
Absolutely. And then after the procedure, we need to monitor her closely, watch for any signs of infection like fever or any bleeding or fluid leakage from the needle site.
Okay, what else?
And we need to be on the lookout for any uterine contractions, which could be a sign of preterm labor. And then we give her clear instructions for what to watch out for at home and when to call the doctor if she has any concerns.
So lots of education and monitoring both before and after the procedure.
Exactly.
Okay, now let's move on to chorionic villus sampling, or CVS. How does this procedure compare to amniocentesis?
So CVS is also used for genetic testing, but the main difference is that it can be done much earlier in pregnancy, usually between 10 and 13 weeks.
Oh, wow. That's a lot earlier than amnio.
It is, yeah. And instead of taking a sample of amniotic fluid with CVS, we're taking a sample of the chorionic villi.
Chorionic villi, what are those?
They're these little finger-like projections that make up part of the placenta.
Okay.
And since the placenta develops from the same fertilized egg as the baby, the chorionic villi have the same genetic makeup as the baby.
Oh, I see. So by testing the chorionic villi, we're indirectly testing the baby's genes.
Exactly.
How do you actually get the sample?
So there are two ways to do it. We can go through the cervix, which is called transcervical CVS, or we can go through the abdomen, which is called transabdominal CVS.
Okay, so similar to amnio, we use ultrasound to guide the needle.
Exactly.
So what are the benefits of doing CVS earlier in pregnancy?
Well, the main advantage is that it gives us those genetic results much sooner.
Right, so families have more time to process the information and make decisions about the pregnancy if necessary.
Exactly. It can be less stressful for some families to know sooner rather than later if there's a genetic problem.
That makes sense. But are there any downsides to doing CVS?
There are a few things to consider. First, like with amnio, there's a risk of miscarriage. And the miscarriage rate with CVS is slightly higher than with amnio.
Okay, so that's something we definitely need to explain to patients.
Absolutely. And another thing to keep in mind is that CVS only gives us information about chromosomes and genes. It doesn't tell us anything about those neural tube defects or lung maturity.
Right, because we're not sampling amniotic fluid. So what about the nursing care for a patient undergoing CVS?
It's a lot like with amnio. We need to do thorough pre-procedure counseling, make sure the patient understands all the risks and benefits, and answer any questions she might have.
Right. Informed consent is key for both procedures.
Absolutely. And then we monitor her closely after the procedure, watching for any signs of bleeding, cramping, or infection.
Got it. And we make sure she knows what to expect and what warning signs to look out for at home.
Right.